Hello, y'all. Welcome back to Group Therapy. I'm one of your hosts, licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Kristen Casey.
I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. Jessica Raven.
I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. Jay.
And I'm licensed clinical social worker, Kristen Gingrich, because I didn't want to do a dissertation.
We got the whole crew here. We're going to talk about addiction today. Can't wait. We're going to talk about all the facets of addiction, not just substances. So settle in, take a seat, and welcome to Group Therapy. We're so excited to have you here, all of us. I have a question for the group to start us off. So when you hear the word addiction, what do you think of? What comes to mind?
Drugs and alcohol.
Alcohol.
My Strange Addiction, the show.
Oh, I haven't seen that show in a minute.
That's the first thing that comes to mind. I don't know why my brain is random, because it's just showing the array of addiction.
We could spend...
That's true. I mean, I think that's a good point.
We could spend a whole episode talking about your brain.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Why it's in my neck and what we can do about that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Justin, I see you. I do. So I can't be serious anymore, guys. So drugs and alcohol, my strange addiction. I want to say I do think of substances first. And when we were preparing for this episode, I was thinking like there's more than just substances. And I don't want to say just to minimize it, but there's a big facet of addiction. And I know in the DSM, sometimes we'll look at like substance use disorders because there's no like, I know Jess was schooling me earlier when I was texting her. I was like, what do you know about addiction? She's like, well, there's no DSM-5 criterion for addiction. And I was like, pump the brakes. Okay, let's talk about it.
So that was a legit conversation.
It was.
And that was your voice, yeah. Jess.
She was schooling me. She was totally schooling me. I was like, yeah, there's no DSM-5 criteria for addiction. But when you think of the umbrella, what else do you think of other than substances, if any?
Pornography,
gambling,
video games,
yeah,
shopping,
yes, yeah,
sex, exercise,
anything, logically,
literally, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's y'all experiences working with addiction?
If we're thinking traditional, like substance abuse, mm-hmm. addiction, that realm. None. Or okay, I don't want to say none. When I get a client that has a substance use disorder, I refer out because that's not my specialty. But if we're thinking of, you know, video games or even exercise, working with eating disorders, like there is some literature out there that eating disorders and addiction like have similar what's the word I'm looking for? Like functions, properties, mm-hmm. neurological responses, things like that. So if we're considering those types of things, then pretty frequently. Social media is another one. I see with a lot of teens, I see a lot of, you know, anxiety, like that fear of missing out, can't get off their phone. It's disrupting their sleep. It's like all of those things. I wouldn't say that's why they're coming to therapy, but if we're conceptualizing the broad spectrum of addiction, it's more in those other realms.
Frequent for nicotine, the most addictive substance there is. I think vaping, nicotine, it's not why people are coming to therapy though, for me. When I was working in university and colleges, I would have a number of students, clients recognize like, oh, my drinking's becoming problematic or... Mm-hmm. I really wish I didn't have to spend so much money on vaping video games. Like I'm not going to class anymore. Like recognizing those types of behaviors, but I've never worked in a traditional addiction recovery setting before.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never worked in a setting in that way. I do work with veterans and we know that like substance use is sometimes comorbid with PTSD. So I work with not in therapy, but in terms of evaluations and assessment, like assessing for those things. But I've never actually been a therapist for someone going through something like that. you know, I don't have much experience. And I find it fascinating that there are so many different like ways to treat it, you know, in terms of like the physical addiction. And then you think of like the emotional stuff that comes along with it. I'm thinking of substances. I have worked with eating disorders before. I've worked with somebody with a gambling addiction before, two people. But my experience is kind of limited, to be honest.
Well, I have a whole license dedicated to substance use. A whole one. I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor. I actually have a good chunk of experience working in substance use. My bachelor's degree internship was in a 30-day rehab. My master's level, one of my placements, was in a 12-day residential treatment facility where I worked with co-occurring, so mental health and substance use. And it was a prolonged program. I worked in outpatient settings with substance use, and I have worked with things like gambling, eating, any form of kind of addiction, social media, nicotine, caffeine. I know, Justin, you said like nicotine is one of the most common, but actually caffeine probably far surpasses that, that we don't actually consider it an addiction because we don't see as much of those negative properties with caffeine addiction. We don't see as much of negative consequences, as we do, you know, with nicotine or gambling or even like social media or media video game. And so, I mean, I've worked with that, like, but again, nobody's coming because no one's coming to therapy solely for their caffeine addiction. It's more like, hey, I see that you've had a Celsius, 12 espresso shots, and two scoops of pre-workout today. How is your heart?
Talking about yourself, aren't you? Yeah. Okay.
Actually, I very much balance it. Okay. That's my justification for it.
No one on this podcast is believing that.
No, we don't believe
you. I didn't get an espresso yesterday because I had pre-workout and a Celsius. So I did not get an espresso drink because I was like, I already had enough.
The harm reduction folks go wild.
They do. We just have to meet her where she's at. This is okay right now. It's okay.
It could be worse. I am in the denial stage of, I'm in like no stage of change at this point. But yeah, I've had a lot of experience, again, mostly working with substances. But a lot of times with substances, there tends to be other addictions there. Like scratch-off tickets or that caffeine addiction. We do find that, you know, when individuals quit substances, especially smoking, they tend to replace that with food or another oral fixation or another addiction, in a way. So yeah, that's my experience.
I love that. I love that. And I think it's incredible that you specialize in it, because I think that when I talk to people in the field, it's either people have all the experience and they specialize in it, or they really don't know much, you know? So it is really, really nice to hear that there are people like you that specialize in it. And I had a question for you, Kristen. I think like when I think of substance use disorders, I want to know, just in your experience or research or whatever, do you notice that there's always something underneath, or can it just be a true substance use disorder? Like in your experience, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say that there isn't one person out there where it isn't just pure substance use, but you know, a lot of times there is something underneath that, whether it's trauma, whether it's, you know, normalized within families. I mean, even with our opioid epidemic that really started in a way of overprescribing pain medications, they were medicating a pain and accidentally got addicted. And so even then, like, there was still something there, whether, and so, you know, to say that there is some, like, that it just happens, I can't really say that that's the case. Again, there's probably one outlier somewhere, but I would say 99.9, there is something else that is precipitating that. And then what happens is it becomes this kind of tumbleweed where it's hard to really see, like, you know, with, especially with mental health, what is mental health and what is substance use and where are those symptoms coming from?
I think a lot of symptoms overlap too, you know, like when it comes to substance use, and just say we're talking about alcohol, like when I'm thinking of like tolerance effects and withdrawal and like feeling irritable and like all those feelings, I mean, just about anybody could feel irritable about anything, you know? So I do think that there's like a lot of overlap too, which makes it hard to discern like where does the etiology come from? Like, what's the origin? Like, I'm thinking about therapy, you know, like how do we kind of deal with this? And I think that there's a lot of treatments out there. It's really nice to hear your stance on it though.
Well, and this goes for anything, even just outside of substances, right? Whether it's video games or sex or food, right? A lot of times we are doing those because it's also giving us something. And it's for a lot of people, it's filling some type of void. Again, not going to say that there isn't someone that stands alone, but it's usually filling something that, again, it just gets tangled in.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that exact thing, KBI, because if we think of, even though K10 made fun of me earlier when, because I was texting her and I was like, there, like, and in full transparency, I was like, this is kind of hard for me because like,
she was like, you don't know shit. You don't know anything.
That's not what I said, but just like, because there's not, we don't use, like, if we're looking at the DSM, which is not like God by any means, but like, we don't say like addiction. We have substance use disorders. We have substance intoxication, and like we can go through those if we want. But I think a lot of people use the term addiction. And so when I think of addiction, it's that like compulsive, chronic, like need for whether it's a substance, a behavior, an activity. And most people, I would argue, in KBI, you can correct me if I'm wrong, at least in the like substance abuse world, don't start a habit or behavior being like, yes, I want to get addicted to this. Like it starts as, you know, maybe it's fun. Like I think of gambling. Maybe you go to a casino once you happen to hit big and then you're like, oh, that was fun. Let me go again. See if I get as like, and it's, and I mean, I don't, we need Barb on to talk about the neuroscience of all of this, but it does, like it hits that dopamine. It affects your pleasure reward system in your brain and you keep going back, even if there's harmful things. And when I think of like compulsive exercise, or if we're talking about like eating, whether restrictive eating disorders or overeating, there's usually an underlying, exactly like you said, a void that's being filled, or it serves a beneficial purpose. So even when harm is being done, the benefits of that or the compulsion to engage in that supersedes any of those harms.
Yeah, I appreciate the way you explain that, Jess, because I think a lot of people, they may be well-intending in different ways, but if you've never suffered from any form of addiction, you might be like, why can't you just stop? But I think in the ways that you describe for people, it's like, if you can conceptualize it through, there's changes going on in the brain that people then have trouble, you know, having pleasure and getting reward from things. And when you're constantly getting these hits from whatever it is we're talking about, substance, behavior, or otherwise, it's hard to pivot back to quote unquote real world and real life when it's like, you're like, I don't feel as good. I'm not getting that high. I'm not getting that hit that the brain just wires. It's like, well, now that's where I'm getting my dopamine from, of like, I'm getting it through video games. I'm about to level up, or I'm getting it through like sex. I just want to hook up with someone. Like, again, the conceptualization, understanding there's changes in the brain that make life really hard. And yet the repetitive behavior and use is making life, of course, even harder because they're not able to keep up with work, friendships, school, you name it.
Totally. It impacts, we know in the DSM, it impacts like every area of functioning. Yeah. I've had a couple of friends who have struggled with addiction, and in different realms. It could be social media, it could be drugs, it could be alcohol, it could be relationships. It could even be, I actually had a couple of friends in high school who they just like did not want to go out. And I was like thinking like, okay, they're just introverted. But I think that they were really struggling with video game addiction and they just didn't want to leave the house. And it was just so hard. I'm like, come on, come out. And they're like, I got to do stuff at home. I'm like, what are you doing at home? Come on, come out, you know? But to leave that would mean to leave that dopamine centered experience. And that's hard for people. And I think when you're weighing things, I think it's easy to judge people with addiction and say, oh gosh, like you're just not an active participant in your life. Just go do things. That is hard when you're in active addiction. That is really, 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 really hard. And I think stopping things cold turkey is really difficult too. I mean, with alcohol, I know we've talked about this. Like, if you're listening and you're struggling with alcohol addiction, you know, it's really not okay to go cold turkey, make sure you get help. But I do think it's hard because you lose a part of, I think a lot of people find meaning and purpose in certain things, and it could become an addiction. It's just difficult.
Well, and I think remember that with addiction, right? Again, even for us, when we say addiction, our first thing goes to drugs and alcohol, right? People don't quite see addiction to video games. They don't see addiction to things like caffeine. They don't see addiction to things like sex. And until it's to a level where it is significantly impacting daily life to the point, oh, wow, I've lost my job. Oh, wow, I've ended up in this terribly dangerous, dangerous situation. And that's, you know, what makes that so different too on some of these other things that kind of, they kind of slide under the radar a lot of the time because they are more socially acceptable in a lot of ways. And because of that, you know, treatment is not really there as much. It's not, people don't real, again, people don't realize that I'm entering into these addiction stages to these things, because it doesn't match the same level as, you know, doing cocaine or, smoking methamphetamine or anything like that. Like, it's so different. But again, at the core of it, they're all the same in the way that they can control your life and can control your decision-making skills.
You make a good point too, because I think that as you were talking, I was thinking about what might it be like to be in that world. And I think you spend an exorbitant amount of time thinking about the thing that you are consumed with and, you know, planning activities around it and stuff like that. It's like, it almost like you're almost like living your life around it, you know? And that's gotta be really stressful for people.
And to KBI's point, I think even some of these things
that's one can of my be favorite
beneficial, like exercise. Like, it's a good example. Like, people are like, well, exercise is good for you. Yes. And taken to the point where it's done too much and you're not going to work or your body's deteriorating, you're harming yourself, then it crosses a threshold. But it's to the point, listen to the video game episode. Video games can have positive effects. But I think it complicates it more when it's more behavioral and we're like, oh, but sex can be really connecting. Who doesn't, you know, in certain ways, love in their relationship, that connection. But sex can also lead to something that is like all consuming, which is the interesting part of these conversations that aren't just about substance.
So true.
Yeah. And Justin, I love that you just said the term all consuming, because I think, you know, a lot of, at least in my experience, people have asked, and once again, not about substances, but like, when do I know it's disordered eating versus an eating disorder? Or when do I know it's like problematic? You know, is my gaming behavior just problematic, or is it an addiction? And I would love to get y'all's thoughts on this, but I definitely think it goes back to what you all have been saying, like when it's impairing those aspects of functioning, when you're losing your job, when you're not sleeping, when you're failing to meet other obligations, when you recognize that it's actually doing harm, but you're still doing it anyway. And something I thought of, K-10, when you were talking earlier is, you know, even when we recognize things are not good for us or harmful for us, and we talk a lot about this in therapy, just as therapists in general, we might recognize it, but we still choose to stay in it because we know it and it's comfortable. And the idea of asking for help can be really scary. The idea of, you know, making change can be really scary. Obviously for substances and KBI, you can talk to this more, like there is a stepwise process with a lot of substances because going cold turkey can do a lot of physiological harm. But for more of like the behavioral addiction, so to speak, sex, exercise, porn, shopping, all of those things, like one, even admitting like, oh, hey, I think I have a sex addiction. That can be
how hard
scary.
Is that to say out loud? That is so hard.
Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. Or like shopping addiction. Like when I think of shopping, you know, it's when, you know, people are like thousands upon thousands of dollars in debt when they're not paying their mortgage, because like those types of things versus like problematic behavior, for me at least, like I think of, you know, it might be interrupting functioning, but it's not fully impairing. So maybe, you know, you're still going to work, you're paying your bills, but you're over, if it's shopping addiction, you're overextending, or like video game addiction, you know, maybe you're not sleeping. I know K10 obviously probably has thoughts on that, but you can still, you know, get up and go to work, or maybe then you're not sleeping. So then you're drinking caffeine and that's a whole nother thing. But any thoughts that you all have kind of the difference between like when something is an addiction versus like, I don't know, problematic behavior edging on addiction?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a spectrum. And I think of like, I just think of what are the consequences for your life? And I think even more importantly, is this values aligned for you? Cause I notice a lot of people who are in addiction with whatever it is that they say, like you're saying, Jess, like, I don't really want to do this, but I find myself doing this. Like, I don't know why I'm doing this. Like, I find myself doing this. And when I talk to clients who are really trying to make changes, they'll say like, I'm scared of change, or it's unpredictable, or I don't know how I'm going to feel, or I don't know if I have the strength to stop. Like, I don't really know if I'm able to do that. And they don't provide themselves with opportunities to change because they're scared. I mean, it's scary to think about changing your life or changing a habit that you've held on to for so long. Cause I think a lot of people find some solace in having control over stuff. And that might be like, hey, I log on to Candy Crush every night at 6 PM and I do that until 10 and it's predictable and I know what to expect and stuff like that. So I know that's only one idea, but I do think there's a spectrum. And then when I think about disordered eating, or when I think of behaviors that kind of get in the way, I sometimes think about like, it really just depends on the person, you know, problematic behavior for one person might not feel the same to somebody else.
Well, and I sometimes think it goes back to, you know, to a person's justification, right? We heard me justifying literally my caffeine addiction. And what that looks like. And one of my favorite things that I'll do with clients is when they're trying to figure out, like, is this difficult? Like, is this an addiction? Anything like that? I'm pulling a Jess and I specifically broke out my DSM. I know. Because I usually go down the alcohol use disorder checklist, but I just take out alcohol. And I say, let's relate to this. So I want people, like, I want our listeners to think about their cell phone while I'm reading this, because I know for a fact we all have a cell phone addiction. But think about it as I read this. So it's just a problematic behavior that leads to significant impairment or distress as manifested by at least two, only two, occurring within a 12-month period. It's often used in larger amounts or over longer periods of time than anticipated or intended. There is a persistent desire or unsuccessful efforts to cut down or control. A great deal of time is spent in activities necessary to obtain it or use it. A craving or a strong desire to use it. Reoccurring use resulting in failure to fulfill major role obligations at work, school, or home. Continued use despite having persistent or reoccurring social or interpersonal problems caused or exacerbated by the effects. Important social, occupational, or recreational activities are given up or reduced because of it. Mm. Reoccurrent use in situations which it's physically hazardous. Texting and driving.
Uh-huh. I didn't think about that.
Use is continued despite the knowledge of having a persistent or reoccurring physical or psychological problem that is likely to be caused or exacerbated by it. Impact of mental health. And then there's talk of just tolerance, which is like needing more, wanting more, that type of stuff. And then that withdrawal. So when you don't have it, it's that want to have it. That kind of withdrawal, like with cell phones, obviously looks very different, but it's kind of like that. Where's my phone? Where is it at? What's it doing? Oh, it's off. Someone could be calling me. So think about it. How many did you guys check off? Because I know I checked off a bunch just reading that.
Yeah. It made me expand almost immediately to be like, it's weird with like the phones. It's just something like it's an artifact in society that we've accepted that it's just going to be part of us. Mm-hmm. And it's like, when did that happen? It makes me think mm-hmm. about technology and integration, but you're right. It like checks all the boxes because the way we do life is now through this thing.
Mm-hmm. And there are obviously like ways to balance and limit and stuff like that to make it more healthy, because it is, the reality is, you know, in our world today, it is really hard to function without it.
Right.
Yeah. Sure.
At this point. Mm-hmm. But there are ways to navigate it. And like that first kind of piece is like, if I took your phone and I set it across the room for an hour, how many times would you be looking over at it when it lit up? Or could you just pretend it stopped existing?
You know what's, I want to know more research on sustained abstinence when it comes to cell phones, because I think like I tried this last year when I got sick. I put my phone away for 3 days. It was three whole days. I was in recovery and I was dealing with a lot, but I was like, I just had like an existential experience. I'm like, let me just like try to live life without my phone. The first day and a half was like really hard. I didn't know what to do with myself. Like I was reaching for it. Like I didn't know like where it was. And then by day three, I was like so calm. I was like, oh wow, this is so nice to just like wake up and just do whatever I want.
You went through withdrawal in a way.
Yeah, I think I did. I honestly think I did, because I was like feeling like this, like, oh my gosh, I want to like, I need to check my notifications and I need to like whatever. But I do wonder if there are therapeutic effects of like reducing screen time that could be helpful, where people don't feel that like urge, you know? But I think it is hard. I feel like now I'm addicted to my phone, now that you said that. Like I really do.
I mean, and again, I think it comes back to where is that line and that balance? Mm-hmm. Because yeah. I think just general use can fall into that criteria. Absolutely. Mm. Just because we use it for work. We spend a lot of time on it. Like, you know,
right.
Just by I use my phone for work, just by working, I spend a lot of time and I check that box. But if I take myself back and I say, okay, work is a necessity versus scrolling TikTok is not, what does that look like? And that can be, again, applied to anything. It can be applied to exercise. It can be applied to caffeine. There are probably people listening and be like, who are sipping Celsius is at 10 o'clock at night. Like,
spit it out.
Wow. But like you can really take that and apply that anywhere in your life and ask yourself those questions and really start to take inventory of, again, what things are serving. It doesn't mean that, again, the cell phone is bad or that exercise is bad or that alcohol that you're drinking is bad. It's really just looking and saying, how is this serving me in this moment? And do I need to have some reevaluation? Because is it a problem, or is it just, even then, it's just not great? And I've checked a couple too many boxes, so I need to reevaluate my relationship here.
And I think so many of this for most people falls in the gray. Like, mm-hmm. I think, you know what I mean? I'll go through times where I'm like if I just use something like Netflix as an example, I go through times where I'm like, yeah, I watch a few shows. Maybe not even every day. And then I'll go through a run where every night for weeks, I like have to watch a new show. And I'm totally like, probably a lot of people, I keep hitting next episode. I'm like, but I gotta know, did they catch him? I know it's the boyfriend. I could tell by the look on his face, it's him. And then it's not the boyfriend. You're like, okay, I'm gonna watch six more episodes. It's like, but for real, like, I think it's interesting how a lot of these behaviors we're talking about, they ebb and flow, change and move. And I'm with you with the reflection of, in a moment, I might be like, my Netflix is fine. Like, I'm not, it's fine. And another time I'm like, the last four nights, I've like sacrificed my sleep and my sleep hygiene because of the addictive nature of how these shows are filmed. And I have to hit next episode. But it's so funny how it will move and change depending on where you are with your video games, your shopping, your social media use.
Well, and remember that our world is built in that, right? True. The world is built to get you to click next episode. Next. And honestly, when you think about it, it comes so much down to that dopamine.
Oh.
And it comes so much down to that I want more. And they've basically learned, you know, in this kind of commercialistic society, how do I hook in people? And it's always about more. And how do I get them to want more?
So true. When did this all happen? Like, was like, you know what I mean? Like when phones came out, I wasn't seeing ads. Obviously it was flip phones and stuff, but like, when did it start to get like targeted? Because I'll say something. I know we talk about this all the time. I'll say something and then it'll show up, but then I'm hooked again. That now I'm on my phone looking at the thing that I was thinking about, you know, and now I'm like really, really just, I can't stop, you know, or if it's like Justin said, like a TV show, KBI, you make a really good point about the dopamine part. And I don't think that we realize that we're in it until we're in it. And then we're like, oh, I'm not getting to work on time. And Justin's point, like I'm not sleeping. And then it's impacting things. You know, I remember when Squid Game came out, I lost sleep. I lost a lot of sleep. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is a really good thing for me. And then there was a bunch of other shows. And the other night I stayed up really late watching Saltburn. I was like, yeah, I'll stop it halfway through and then I'll like finish the rest. I just couldn't stop. I was like, it's midnight. I don't care. I'm doing it. Whatever. Cause I was hooked. Like I couldn't stop. I felt like I could, but I just didn't want to, you know?
You asking that, K10, you know, made me think like reflecting on the people in my life that I've known that have had like substance abuse disorders. You know, part of the, you know, compulsive pattern is like needing to seek out that drug, alcohol, whatever it is, like, you know, okay, I don't have this. So then I go to this. And how our society is, especially with the things we've been talking about, gaming, internet, cell phones, social media, those are things that we have access to 24/7. So we're like, if we have the urge, we can fulfill that need right then and there versus like maybe other, like when we think of traditional addiction and like substance abuse, like whether it's having to, you know, if they're illegal illicit substances, like having to go to your dealer, if it's alcohol, having to go to the store, things like that. Most people have a cell phone. Most people have access to internet. So like we get that hits all the time. And exactly like KBI said, like these capitalist companies know what they're doing with marketing. I mean, we're all on TikTok. Like, I mean, Instagram's the same thing, but like the short form videos that like for like they know what they're doing, and it's that reward system. It's like the slot machines when you're gambling.
Oh God, K10 was in Vegas with me when I was winning big, and what did I do? Got like I was up like $500, and I was like, yeah. What did I do? Blew it.
I was like, just walk away. Just walk away.
I can't stop hitting the button. And in my head, like, I looked at it as like, okay, I came here with $200 to blow. Like, that's my, like, whatever. I'm not spending more. And like, I didn't, but I left. I think I left with like a smidge. I think I left with like $100 up. Mm-hmm. I think I was like, but like, at the end of the day, I was like, I could walk away, but I could win more.
You could.
I could.
And you didn't.
But it does that. And that's how anything ropes you in. Again, like food, like it just, it in lots of moments, it feels good.
Mm-hmm.
I think too, it's like, it feels, and I don't know if this is across the board with every addiction, but it almost feels like so easily accessible. Like just mentioned, it also feels like captivating in a way. Like, I don't know about you. Like if I'm on TikTok or Instagram and I'm like scrolling and I know that I should stop, it's because the information is in like bite-sized pieces. It's like 7 seconds. And I'm like, oh yeah, I want to see more because it was quick. It was like instant gratification. It was so easy. But if I have to watch like a longer form anything, I'm just going to have to sit. I'm going to have to wait. I'm going to have to take it in, you know? But if I'm in that headspace where I just like want information in the moment, it's like just so easy to scroll and just get lost in it.
Do any of you guys know any of the treatment approaches to any of these things?
No.
Detox.
So Detox. Yeah. I mean, for substance, it tends to be, you know, especially when there's the mental health, we do want to see 30 days of sobriety so we can really begin to suss out what was substance, what is mental health. Motivational interviewing, it mm-hmm. tends to be the really common approach. Because the reality is like, we have to get you to a place where you are motivated to do the work to make those changes. But honestly, because it too is so intertwined with like mental health and trauma, especially like substances, you know, any of those trauma, like EMDR, DBT, all of that all really works. But, and then there's all those other like modalities, AA, NA, Al-Anon, Smart Recovery, a million of those that you can also do alongside as well.
Yeah, I don't know a ton, but I was even thinking from like the behavioral, more behavioral addictions that we've touched on, cell phones, gaming, all those types of things. I mean, this is not my area of expertise by any means. This is me just kind of going off the cuff. I do think like, what is the purpose it's serving? What is the underlying, like that void or the comorbidity that maybe needs to be addressed? Is there trauma, things like that, harm reduction approach? All of those types of things. And I also think of just like when you're trying to change a behavior, like on a very small scale, this is not an addiction, but like I've worked with people that are like, I want to stop biting my nails. And like, you have to find what is the function, what is the replacement behavior, things like that. So I would imagine with some behavioral based addictions, you would take a similar approach. Motivational interviewing, looking at like stages of change. Are you motivated to change? You know, what is this serving, et cetera?
Yeah, I think in the stages of change model too, with like, with nicotine too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the only one I really know of.
But know what we do know? Research.
That Jess has always got it down.
We
scholar short.
We know research.
We do.
So, addiction, we're talking about it. I wanted to find a new article, something maybe we haven't touched on. So, I did find another 2024 article. You know, we're now 30 solid days at the time of recording into wow. 2024. And so the question I'm going to pose to you all is, what do you think the relationship between adverse childhood experiences and internet addiction is? KBI's dancing. Hi? Is that what that dance is?
It's correlation.
She's talking about a positive correlation.
There's a positive high correlation.
Yeah, okay. I would assume the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So like I said, this study came out in 2024. So overall, the analysis revealed a significant increase in the prevalence of internet addiction with an increase in ACE exposure. So the prevalence increased from 52.5% in the zero ACE category, so somebody that had no adverse childhood experiences, to 80.6% in those that had greater than four ACEs. So compared to individuals with an ACE score of zero, risk for internet addiction was found to be 1.46-fold higher in the 1 to 3 ACE category, which was statistically not significant. So
right.
0 to 3 ACEs, you're good. And then 3.82-fold higher in the 4 ACEs or above category, which was significantly or statistically significant. And then regarding the relationship between ACE domains and internet addiction, of the 13 study ACE domains, okay, only one was found to be statistically significant. Which do you want to guess? I'm putting you all on the spot. Pull out your ACEs.
All I know is I feel like I'm about to be read like a fucking book.
I don't know. You might not want to out yourself on the internet.
What the hell? KBI's like, this song is about me.
So exposure to sexual abuse was the only one to be significantly associated with risk of internet addiction. So wow. Participants who reported having experienced sexual abuse were found to be at 1.97-fold significant increase of internet addiction than those who were not a victim of sexual abuse in childhood. Further, though the association between being bullied and internet addiction did not reach the level of statistical significance, exposure to childhood bullying was found to be associated with a four-fold increase risk of internet addiction.
Wow.
So one theory from this paper was among young adults dealing with like psychological and emotional repercussions of ACEs, overuse of the internet or digital devices may be maladaptive coping mechanisms or avenues for escape. Thoughts? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, especially when you bring up like the maladaptive part. I also think of some of those ACEs, like the ACE scores, and how they impact parenting and maybe the supervision that the children, that kids have, mm-hmm. and their amount of access that they may have because of that. I think that that also plays a part, but it makes complete sense to me. I mean, as I sit here with my ACE score, I'm like, yeah, well, and I make videos on the internet. It checks out.
Yeah. If the shoe fits, you know, I mean,
I don't know. I was going to say, no, else checks out? The polls.
The polls.
So thank you, KBI, for talking. As I say every episode that I have to do the polls after doing Google Scholar Shorts, I appreciate you talking so I can pull the polls up. So I did the polls this week. Obviously, we're talking about addiction. Okay, so the first question I asked is a definition. A compulsive, chronic, physiological, or psychological need for a habit-forming substance, behavior, or activity having harmful physical, psychological, or social effects and typically causing well-defined symptoms upon withdrawal or abstinence is the definition of, per Merriam-Webster, because we know that I've already ranted about this, that it's not included in the DSM. Is it the definition of addiction, substance use disorder, problematic behavior, or intoxication?
Addiction.
Yeah, I guess addiction.
Okay. Correct. Addiction. It is addiction.
Yes.
63% of group members said that, followed by 36%. What was that accent that just came out of my mouth? Saying substance use disorder. Only 1% said problematic behavior and 0 said intoxication. And then I asked, have you or someone you known had an addiction? Yes, no, unsure.
Yes.
I would say yes is the highest.
80%.
Yeah. Yes was the highest at 89%.
Damn.
Followed by no at 5 and unsure at 6.
Wow, that's higher than I was expecting.
And then there's me, and I'm like, I want to be devil's advocate and be like, that should be at 100% because we all know someone with a caffeine addiction.
That's true. Probably. It's one of those things. Yeah.
Or then, again, I go tobacco. Like, most people don't even see that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I really liked this one, and I'm going to quiz you all as well. The DSM-5-TR includes blank separate classes of drugs under substance-related disorders. 5, 7, 10, or 12?
Oh.
7.
I was literally thinking 7.
I'm a bad substance use provider. I'm like, I think 7.
So our group members also thought 7 at 44%, followed by 5 at 30%, 10 at 17%, and 12 at 8%. It is actually 10. So we have, really? I have them pulled up. So we have alcohol, caffeine, cannabis, hallucinogens, inhalants, opioids, sedatives, and hypnotics or anxiolytics are classified in 1, stimulants, tobacco, and other.
That'd be 10 if you're counting at home.
Wow.
Yes. Yep. Okay. And then this is another fun one I learned. Gambling disorder, previously known as pathological gambling, was added to the DSM in 2013 with the DSM-5, 2000 with the DSM-4-TR, 1994 in the DSM-4, or 1980 in the DSM-3.
TR, DSM-4 TR.
Do you know for certain, or are you taking a guess?
I feel pretty good, but not 100%.
Because I was thinking like the earlier ones, like the 80s or 90s or whatever. But I don't know.
So the vast majority of our group members, yes, 2013 with the DSM-5, followed by 2000 with the DSM-4-TR, followed by 1994 with the DSM-4, followed by 1% guessing 1980 with the DSM-3. Congratulations to that 1%. It was added in 1980 in the DSM-3.
There we go. Old school.
So, hold on. Let's see if I can. Four people. Shout out to the four of you.
Shout out to the four.
Let's go.
You'll get something in the mail.
Aslan, Angela, Kelson, Ashley. Congratulations.
That's incredible.
And then the last question I asked is, which of the following is included in the DSM-5-TR under conditions for further study? Sex addiction, internet gambling disorder, or internet gaming disorder, sorry. Porn use disorder or shopping compulsion. So sex, internet, porn, shopping.
Oh. I don't know.
I guessed internet. I didn't know.
You are correct, Justin. It's internet, and our group members got that. So 50% guess internet gaming disorder. So that's under conditions for further study. The other ones I just made up names for, but most popular was shopping compulsion, followed by porn use disorder, followed by sex addiction. But those were all pretty close at 14, 16, and 20%. So there we go.
Wow.
There we go. Right into the group member questions. Wherever you are, here or far, outside KBI's window, riding a moose, in North Carolina, coming straight out of Charlotte to go see Jess, and I always forget where K-10 is in Missouri, but someplace in that oval-shaped state. We're glad you're here and asking these great questions. First off, M from outer space, that's what M put. M asked this question, but so many people asked this question. I think it was definitely the most asked. Do you think self-harm is addiction or can be addiction?
I think it can be. I don't think it is, if that makes sense. Ooh, like, I think the vast majority of people that engage in self-harm, it's not an addiction. The reason I think it can be, because I have worked with a few clients that have explicitly told me, I don't get relief from self-harm anymore, but I have no desire to stop because I feel a compulsion to do it. Even though they can verbalize it's hurting them. They can verbalize it does not feel good anymore. And it's more of that behavioral compulsion and need. And the individuals I'm thinking of that have engaged in that, it's not, you know, I conceptualize self-harm as a coping skill. You know, so typically when people engage in self-harm, it's when they're really like emotionally dysregulated, really upset, things like that. The few clients I can think of that have expressed this to me, it's like, I'm just sitting in class and I have this urge to self-harm, or like I go to the bathroom and I have the urge to self-harm. It's not necessarily tied to some type of need to cope, with emotions. So I think for most people, it's not, but I think it also goes back to everything we were talking about. Like, is it impairing functioning? Like, is it causing more harm? Things like that.
I think that was so well answered. Everything that you had named is what I was thinking when I was reading all the people asking about that nuance. Like, it could be, but is it typically, is what my mind went to as well. Ashley from NH, New Hampshire. Oh, I got the head nod approval from KBI.
New England besties, our next door neighbor.
Hey, how you doing? It's not the accent they have there, but it's the first one that came to mind. It was Long Island.
Close enough.
Just in my mind all the time. The nuance of this question is interesting. I think we can talk about it more broadly as well. But my dad is addicted to alcohol. He thinks he doesn't get blackout drunk anymore, so he's better. What's your thoughts on this? Is he still addicted? Is he better? Harm reduction?
Yeah. I mean, there are ways to manage your addiction. I know people who won't drink liquor because they get blackout. and will only drink beer. But they still drink a 24 pack of beer. That's still an issue. There are definitely people out there who, you know, function really well in active addiction. And the problem is that if you aren't really experiencing consequences of those behaviors, you're not seeing the consequences of those behaviors, you don't see it as a problem. And that is pretty common for people, is like, if you're not experiencing those things, then it's really hard for you to admit that there's something wrong with it, because maybe there isn't, other than maybe some health things and it just not being good to drink a 24 pack of Bud Light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm even thinking too of like blackouts and how a lot of people who are struggling with alcohol use still drink alcohol in more amounts than intended. And then that might lead to blackouts, who knows, you know? And then I think of tolerance effects, like are people blacking out because they need more alcohol to achieve their desired effect? You know, like where does that come from? And to say that he's an addiction or not, I mean, we can't really assess it, right? From afar, unfortunately. But I think some education about addiction is helpful. And KBI, I love to hear your thoughts on that. That was great.
I might be like hyper-focusing on the wrong thing, but like the last part of that question, still addicted or better? Like my first thought is it can be both. Like he's better in the sense of like, okay, he's not blacking out drunk, so maybe there's some reduced like safety issues. But just if that's the only thing that has changed about his pattern of behavior, addiction could absolutely still be present. And I don't know, people ascribe to different things. Like some people are like, once an addict, always an addict. Some people are like, nope, you can fully recover. And, yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, I'm glad to hear that your dad doesn't get blackout drunk anymore. Especially since it obviously has impacted you. I know we're all very like, what does this mean? I'm curious to know more. But like, what does better mean? Like, does for your dad, like, was blackout drunk the only sign that he had a problem? Now he doesn't do that. Oh, I'm have no issues. Or, okay, is he better functioning, but he still has problematic behavior? So like K-10 said, like, we can't diagnose your dad, but I would be concerned if other patterns hadn't changed other than that, personally.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the mindset of sobriety or bust is, it works for some people, but I think it misses a lot of people, where improvements, of course, what KBI was saying, like can be made that can be, you know, damn near life changing, and it might not be sobriety. Let's see here. Kara from Arizona. We touched on this a little bit. I kind of want to know from y'all's experiences. You don't have to Google anything here, Jess. Get your hand off the button. How much of addiction is rooted in trauma? Or how much of it is a trauma response? How, in your experiences, y'all have been in a lot of different settings, working with a lot of different people. What's your instinct here?
I have never worked with a person who came in with a substance use disorder, specifically drugs and alcohol, who did not have some form of a trauma response or a traumatic background. Even the individuals I worked with who were prescribed opiates after a surgery, most of the time they were like, yeah, it just made me not feel anything and it became great. And I have yet to work with someone who does not have a like trauma. And again, doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Sure. Right. Sure.
But I've yet to find someone.
For me, I'm just thinking in the archive of all the people that I've seen, and is it a trauma response in every situation? I'll say no. I think for me, just from a clinical perspective, I think it's a way of avoidance, and that could be linked to trauma potentially, but I don't know if it's always that, always every single time. I think people use alcohol or substances as a way to cope, at least the clients that I see. and at least the clients that I've seen in the past. And then, like KBI said, I mean, I've seen a lot of people who have, you know, had a medical issue and then they've taken pills and they got addicted. My goodness. And then it's like, how did I get here? You know? But I always think that they're with substances. I always feel like that there's something underneath. Is it trauma? It could be. Is it something else? Maybe.
Anonymous, our neighbors up north in Canada. How do you recognize the seeds of addiction in yourself before they grow and completely take over? I'm great at seeing things in retrospect, but in the moment, I'm kind of oblivious. So many of us are, right? Mm-hmm. How do we pause and slow down? We've thrown out some things throughout the course of this episode, but if someone's curious about it, like what do you do? How do you take stock?
My thought was do what KBI did to all of us already on this episode. But honestly, mm-hmm. like, especially for, and I'm speaking more from like a behavioral addiction standpoint. So those like non-substance things, you know, pausing and taking inventory, like, are you feeling anxious when you're not having access to your phone? Are you noticing that your shopping is, you know, putting you in debt or, you know, preventing you from being able to pay certain bills on time? You know, if it's like a sex or porn addiction, is that consuming a lot of your time and energy? Are you noticing or starting to notice like you're not getting as much pleasure from whatever the thing was originally, but you still feel like a need to engage in those things? Maybe do a little experiment with yourself. Like I'm thinking, going back to like shopping, maybe you do a lot of online shopping, put stuff in your cart, and then step away for a day. Mm-hmm. How do you feel in that time? Like, are you feeling like so overwhelmed and anxious and like, oh my gosh, I have to go check it or da, 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 da. That might be signs that, okay, this is more than just like a fun spending habit. Those are my initial thoughts.
Kind of along the lines of what you said, I think, and I think Justin would know more about this with the mindfulness-based stuff, but like taking inventory about like what's working for you and what isn't, like what is actually serving me? What am I doing every single day that's giving me good benefits or not? You know, I mean, I think it requires a lot of mindfulness. It requires a lot of intention. And I think like to your point, the person who asked this question, it is hard to in real time notice these things. Like, I just want to highlight that. That's really hard. I think in hindsight, it's so easy to say like, oh yeah, that's where I noticed it. You know, cause you could take the data when you look back and you could connect the dots. But when you're trying to look forward, connecting the dots, it's so much harder. But one thing that's worked for me, and I don't know if this is right or not. Every Sunday, I kind of take inventory of like what has worked for me this week and what hasn't. And it could be things that I even find fun and enjoyable. Like, what did that do for me? You know, and if I notice I'm like engaging in a behavior more so than not, okay, what does that mean? Is it just fun? Is it cool? Or is it becoming a problem?
And I know we talked about this in our dry January side session, like, especially like for things like alcohol, right? Sometimes things are so ingrained in our daily life that we don't realize it has become a problem because it is so natural to us. And like you said, K10, like taking that inventory. So you might not realize that you have a slight drinking problem because you're going out and having two or three liquor drinks every single night with your friends at different bars and different groups of friends and doing all of this because you're, you know, you see it as like, I'm hanging out with friends. I'm doing all of this. Until you take the inventory and you realize, wow, I just drank 18 of the last 17 days. And it wasn't like I had, like, I make a little craft cocktail at home and I have one. It's, oh, wow, I've had like three or four drinks every day for the last 17 out of 18 days. And it sometimes comes into that mindfulness of just looking at the things that you're doing often and really just kind of looking at what that looks like.
All right, we got time for one more here. All the way down under, Cassandra asks a really important question. I really like this one. Why does it feel super awkward to talk about porn addiction with your therapist? How have you handled this touchy subject with a client before?
I would say for me, like, I, when clients have brought it up, I have kind of just said, like, this is just a thing. This is a thing. It doesn't matter what it is. I want to be able to talk to you about it. But I think sometimes it is so hard to talk about because, you know, talking about sex with your therapist can be hard. It can be awkward. It can be weird. Like, I'm going to talk about my dick with someone. Like, it can be really weird. Mm-hmm. We don't think it's weird. Like, we want you to talk about it if that's something you want to focus on. But a lot of times, you know, and then you add in like kind of the shame that is associated with it.
Yeah.
In a way. Then you add that layer to it that makes it even harder. And I think like not wanting your therapist to think any less of you, we won't. But, you know, that's, I think, plays that whole piece to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's just naturally some like shame and stigma around porn. There's differing views and opinions on it. And, you know, I think even just in your question, Cassandra, about like touchy subject, like even using that verbiage that stuck out to me is like, why does it have to be a touchy subject? It's because society has told us it is a touchy subject. And so, you know, if we already have internalized like feelings about porn or what it should be or should not, like if we should watch it or should not, things like that. As for like, how have I handled this with a client? I can, working with primarily teens and children, I can only remember one time it was actually like brought up and we just talked about it very like matter of fact, like, how are you feeling about it? Why is this distressing for you? Do you want this to change? Things like that, like just no judgment, because you can't have judgment because then the person is gonna not want to talk about it anymore. And it will kind of reinforce that feeling of, oh, it's a touchy subject. It's off limits, things like that.
Mm-hmm. No, I want to echo everything that you guys said. When people come to me and they say like, hey, I have this like, I don't know what it is. I can't stop, or it's something that I think about really often and it's impacting my relationship or it's impacting, you know, intimacy or something. I always try to create a space where somebody feels that I'm not ever judging them, because if I put myself in their shoes, I'd probably feel a lot of shame too. You know, I'd probably feel really demoralized about it. And oh my gosh, how did I get here? And, I think when it comes to the porn industry and porn in general, I think it's easy to get sucked in. You know, so I don't blame people for that at all. And I also think too, if it's depending on what it is, if it's like impacting relationships, I'm not a couples therapist, so I might have to refer out for certain things. If it's like, hey, they need couples therapy or something. But if it's the individual client talking to me about it, oh my gosh, tell me anything. Nothing is TMI in therapy.
So true. As therapists, we're really curious and we lean into any sort of disclosure. Mm-hmm. I think that's the cool part about being a therapist is we tend to be really open, flexible people who want to know how any behavior is fitting your values, your life, within your narrative. And everything's up the table to explore. And I will say, I know I say this a lot, we pretty much heard everything. So, and it's cool because human behavior is so vast. And we appreciate you forming a trusting relationship with us, that you trust us to explore that and talk about those things. Because, yeah, in society, things can feel taboo, but in the therapy room, nah, not so much, my friend.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of Welcome to Group Therapy. You know, we talked about all different facets of addiction, from what we most know them for is substance and alcohol, to, you know, pornography, sex, gambling, all of that and everything in between. Make sure that you rate, review, and subscribe to this episode. Drop it in the group chat. Let us know what you think, and we will see you next week on Group Therapy. Bye.
Peace.